Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. I'm here with Jim Fecto of Fecto Homes in, Jim, Berlin or Montpelier?
We're in Montpelier.
In Montpelier, okay. Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad you're here. Welcome, and I don't know those of you who know Fecto Homes. It's a Vermont company owned and operated by the Fecto family. Jim, can you talk a little bit about Fecto Homes and especially the scope of your business?
Yeah, so Fecto Homes is it's in Montpelier on River Street. We have our display center there. And we're a retailer of modular and manufactured housing. We deal with eight or so manufacturers. We operate in Vermont and New Hampshire. If it's local projects, we'll do site work, concrete, plumbing, electrical. Our staff is pretty well versed in housing and all the problems that can come up. So we do help with financing, permits. And also, as a side business, we do some development in central Vermont, residential developments, and some rentals.
So. Excellent. You got the whole gamut. You know, we talked once, and you and I were talking about tiny homes. You haven't gotten into tiny homes, have you?
We haven't. We had the park models for a little while, and that failed. So we got out of it.
Well, that's a reason to get out of it. I just like those tiny homes. There's two in Barrie, fairly near my home.
Yeah.
And I ride by them every once in a while. I think they're so compact. It's sort of like an RV. Like, you know, we camp in the summer. Yeah. We have an RV, and it's sort of like that.
Yeah, the first time we got into the business, I actually had to buy the last model and it myself. And and the second time, I almost had to do the same thing. So I think we're out of that business.
Right. Well, sorry to hear that, because that's actually a good alternative, because the housing here in Vermont is pretty much a crisis point at this point, I would think.
You think there would be. You think there'd be you know, more campgrounds like there are in Maine and other states that have that as an option to do seasonal housing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So you guys started out as a conventional builders, correct?
Yeah.
And then switched over, and I'm just wondering, why did you do that?
Well, my father, he's French-Canadian. I don't know if the last name gave it away, but he moved to the United States and was working here in probably the late 60s. And, you know, that was the labor. Labor came from Canada at the time to work in the mills, the granite industry, construction. And he ended up settling in Barrie and started a construction company. And he operated that in the 80s. Got up to probably about 50 employees, was doing framing, roofing, and siding. And in the late 80s, we had a recession. Things slowed down. Burlington is where he did a lot of his work, and he was kind of pulling out of that market. So he took probably a 3 or 4 year hiatus.
Oh.
But he had accumulated some properties in central Vermont and that could be developed subdivisions. And not having as much labor on hand, he started looking at manufactured housing as a way to put houses on his properties and sell them, use the lots.
Right.
And so then, you know, people come and they say, well, I want to buy one of these, but I want to buy it, you know, on my lot in Plainfield or whatever. And so he started selling retail. That was probably 95, 96. It just kind of evolved from there. And then now we're mostly retail, and we do some development. But, you know, most of it is retail to people in Vermont and New Hampshire.
That's great, and we love it.
Yeah.
Vic Fecto and Pat Fecto, they're two of my favorite people in Vermont, if they're listening. Bonjour. Anyway, I had asked you this once before, and your work is it lightens up a little bit, I would assume, in the winter months. What keeps you kind of busy? Are you doing the construction that you talked about? Or
yeah, over the years, because if you – good help is hard to find. I think we all know that.
Oh, amen to that.
Yeah. So if you find them, these guys, they can't – they have a hard time living on unemployment. So
right.
We try to keep our guys busy year-round. And so in the wintertime, over the past, you know, 8, 10 years, we've had condo projects that we would buy permits in. and stick build, you know, some condos.
Right.
And now we have a project in Barrytown. It's 90 units. I think we've probably got 20 in there now. And we put foundations in this time of year. The retail part of our business wraps up probably December, January. So come February, we're going to end up having houses come in, and the guys will work on those.
Well, you've certainly expanded your lots down by where your offices are.
Yeah.
Because you've got a lot of models.
Yeah. Almost
up and down the. Yeah. No, it's fine. I love it. I love to see them because they're a lot of them are built to spec, are they not? I mean, people like myself, if I wanted to buy one, I could come in and work with you on what the interior, exterior should look like.
Yeah.
And what I like about it is that they're done in a controlled environment, are they not? So it's not like they're outside with the weather and all that stuff. So when it arrives, it's fresh out of the plant.
Yeah. I mean, it's as far as being built to spec, that part of the business is coming back. But during COVID, we started to see lead times go out. We used to be 6 weeks, so you could order a custom house.
Right. And but good luck getting it.
Yeah, good luck getting it. So then it went from 6 weeks, and then it kept going, you know, 16. And we had some manufacturers delivering 18 months order. So in late 2020, we just started ordering houses that we thought would appeal to people have sold in the past. So as they started coming in, they were selling. So that's been our business model for the last couple of years. But now I'm actually getting calls from manufacturers saying, hey, you know, do you have anything in the pipeline? So that's giving me the indication that their backlog is starting to tighten up. So now you probably could get a house in 6-8 weeks. But
well, that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think
because when you build a house, I think some of the towns want you to build it in a certain amount of time.
Yeah, yeah.
If you get a loan, they want it done.
Yeah,
so
start to finish is 16 to 20 weeks for most
things. 6-8 weeks is nothing.
Yeah.
Because I love what I watch, and we camp all summer in Maine, and we put on a Florida room, which we call a mud room in honor of Vermont, and a porch, and it's just made the whole thing completely different. So there are some tweaks you can do which make them fabulous.
Yeah, but as far as being built in a controlled environment, these are built on like an assembly line, you know, so each station has employees that do nothing but that part of the component. So it makes it more efficient, and I think that drives the cost down. The automation's not there yet, but I think in Europe the manufacturers of housing have started to use more automation.
Right.
So it's only sort of
like
a
car assembly line, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's
so, and there's no weather related delays. So you know, if it's snowing or raining, it really doesn't matter. Construction goes on. Site built construction. If you haven't planned your rainy day work, the day is shot.
Yeah.
You know. So, and all the materials are stored inside. And these factories have a lot of buying power compared to just a regular builder. You know, if they're ordering carpet, they're ordering, you know, enough for 50 houses.
Right.
So they're buying power.
Helps on the overall price at the end.
It brings the price down. Yeah.
I know I told you this story before, but it kills me. I was brought up in Florham Park, New Jersey. Don't ask me where that is. But anyway. But people down the street had ordered a modular home. First one anybody had seen in my area, the entire town came out to watch this thing come down the road and be put up. It was like the best movie ever.
Yeah.
It was amazing. People were so excited and it was tight. They didn't have any, you know, the big issue these days is weatherization.
Yeah.
These things are tight.
Yeah.
And,
and they come down the interstate at, you know, 65 miles an hour.
Right.
So they've got to be well built.
Well, we had more fun with, I remember as a kid just watching this thing. I thought, good grief. But, the people that owned it were really, really thrilled. So I was doing a little research and I want to just read something really quick from your national association. It said manufactured housing is already a major part of the solution to the nation's lack of affordable housing. More than 22 million people in the U.S. live in manufactured homes. In many parts of the U.S., these homes are the least expensive kind of housing available without government subsidy. And I think that's true, isn't it? What a great alternative to housing.
I think it's absolutely a critical part of housing.
Right.
Has been for years. And not only for starter homes, you know, we see a lot of people selling a big house,
yeah,
and then they're buying a manufactured home in a community.
Right.
And, you know, they leave for the winter. They just winterize it and come back in the spring.
And
so
there it is.
I think it's a great it's a great alternative. And the quality of the construction continues to improve, and it's merging with site built. So, you know, low E windows are now pretty much a standard, and insulation and that kind of stuff. The standards have come up.
That's great. It's very exciting. So, Jim, let's pick up on the conversation. Last time we talked, you were talking about the cost and availability of lumber or other supplies and how they might impact your business. And you mentioned shingles. Are things calming down now?
Yeah, it used to be a problem to get shingles and, I mean, just the basic siding.
Right.
Furnaces, we'd houses come without furnaces, houses come without appliances. It was just a shortage, but it seems to have stabilized. And I actually this morning before I left, my brother, we had ordered a whole truckload of ductile, 8-inch ductile iron we use for, you know, municipal water lines. And we were supposed to get it next May. That was the expected delivery date as of a month ago. And he got a call yesterday that he's going to get it next week. So I'm wondering if, you know, and like I said earlier, now we're getting calls from our manufacturer saying, you know, I could get you a house in 6 weeks or 8 weeks. So I think it's starting to relax. And if I had to guess, you know, obviously higher interest rates, inflation's taking a toll.
Right.
You know, maybe people can't save the money to buy a house or build a house right now. So there's a lot of, I think, financial pressure on folks. And
yes, there is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's going to help the supply chain. And that excess supply should bring the prices down too. So
is a lot of your supplies, are they caught up like in the shipyards, or are they, it's mostly from around the United States?
Most of our stuff's probably produced domestically.
Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I hope. I mean, I could be misspoken, but
no, because that mess out in the docks and stuff out in California is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Sitting out there.
Yeah, and I don't know what this. You know, you don't know what these storms are going to do to the supply chain too, because there are a ton of units to rebuild.
Right.
You know, in Florida and other places now. So.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was telling you. My cousin was telling me that good luck finding somebody to fix the homes down in Florida. And then the supply. It's going to be a while before these people see the light of day.
Yeah, I think they're in for a long haul.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, so you were mentioning that you do site work, sewer, road, blah, blah, blah. And the whole process has got so many components to it. I was just wondering about how all of that impacts the pricing, because you need to make a profit, but your customers need to be able to afford the bottom line. How does that all kind of come together, and as opposed to traditional housing?
Right. Well, I think, you know, to the same extent, the factory model, you know, kind of works its way down to us. We do a volume of activity in electrical work, in plumbing.
Okay.
We do a volume in concrete, welds, site work. So we team up with local contractors, and they're working for us 60 to 75% of the time. So, you know, we work on an agreement. We know what the service is going to cost us. And then we know in our pricing that, you know, it's not going to vary, and we can provide the customer assurance that, you know, if it's $100,000, it is $100,000. It's not going to float.
Right.
In the last couple of years, we've had to keep, you know, contingency, because freight rates are all over the place. And these factories were such, you know, the backlog was so far out that they didn't know what the 2x6 was going to cost them in 12 months. So there was a little bit of variation, but it's as the delivery times tighten up, it's a little more predictable. And
that's
we can
great.
Go, but it, yeah, I mean, the efficiency comes from that. And we also, we've started to focus on what we're good at. So we don't offer all the extra, the porches, the garage.
The mudrooms.
Yeah, the mudrooms, exactly. the lanais. Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, we do that. We do the house And that's what we're good at.
Right.
We're moving and setting houses. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody wants a deck built, not to say that we wouldn't do it, but they're going to save money having a smaller contractor
local.
With less overhead. Our overhead is gigantic compared to somebody with a pickup and a ladder rack. And they
that's good you know that and recognize it. And
we look at all our jobs, and I keep joking. I'm like, after we get the house set, that's when we start losing money.
Interesting. Well, at our camp, we've got a guy that just does it, and within a couple of days, you've got a lanai and a porch, and you're all set. But I think any of these, if you've got the land, they can expand on any of these mobile. Homes, can't they? Manufactured homes.
Yeah, the modulars are just like a site-built house. So you
just
take the siding
on.
Off and add on.
Yeah.
So mobiles are a little tougher, but you can expand on them. So.
That's great. So I hate to bring up the word regulations, but you've got to deal with them on a daily basis, federal, state, local. You've got HUD code, housing, anti-discrimination rules, regulations. How do you keep up with everything? Plus, you've got to deal with the community and what they vision for their community, their planning efforts. How do you keep it all current? And
this was an upbeat conversation until now.
Sorry. Regulations always get people. It's like, great.
We deal with it from the local to the state.
Right.
And then on the HUD code stuff, we're required to be licensed to install the houses so we have a federal oversight on that. And we get a report, where the homes go and who they're sold to. So, we're dealing with that all the time, and zoning and, zoning and building permits.
Is there somebody in your office that's sort of in charge of looking at the regs? And especially right here in Montpelier, at our state house, they must keep you busy sometimes.
Yeah.
Because they've got their Act 2. They've been trying to get Act 250 rewritten for the last couple of years, and a couple of the things they've suggested have been a little scary.
Yeah. I pay attention, and then our legislators, let us know
what's going on. Good.
There's the Home Builders Association,
right.
AGC, all those guys keep track of what's going on. And we get a lot of our information about the national, any national items from the manufacturers. Share information
back and
forth.
Because they can sneak a few things through without you even knowing
it
sometimes. Yep. They just kind of put it on. Your national association seems to be right on top of things. I looked them up before the show, and they're really out there.
Yeah, they're aggressive, and they're in Washington watching for the interests of the manufactured housing. And I mean, these companies that build these things are now, I mean, they're giant conglomerates.
Right.
And they've merged over the years, and so they have a lot of power.
That's
so
great. You've been out there for years here. What's your take on Vermont's housing market? I mean, we've got an old stock of housing.
Yeah.
And I don't know where the demand is these days. I know for a while during COVID, people were buying houses from out of state, sight unseen, just to move here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was, COVID brought a lot of people to Vermont to telework.
Right.
And I think it was – Vermont's an appealing place because, if you can sell a house in Long Island and come up here and buy a farm.
Yeah. So, 500,000 acres more.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I think it's appealing to come up here and a beautiful place to live, but it did create a crunch on what was already a pretty small inventory. And I think the other thing that's probably driven, prices and is – we had 3%, interest rates for
a
couple of years.
Right.
And now we're up to probably around 7. So I just did a couple.
7%?
Yeah, it's approaching 7. Yeah, for a 30-year mortgage. So $1,500 a month, 3% buys you $355,000. At 7%, it buys you $225,000.
Good grief.
So that's a dramatic change in buying power. And but the prices are still up there. This summer I was watching the inventory in the MLS, and there was probably 15 in Barrytown, Barry City, Berlin, and Montpelier. Those are the four I always look at.
Right.
There was probably 15 listings in July, let's say, and five of them were ours, you know, houses we were going to build.
Right.
I looked yesterday in preparation for this, and there was around 40, but eight were over 500,000, and there was only 13 under the $300,000 range. So, you know, there's not a lot of affordable homes available.
That is not affordable.
It's not, no. So. Yeah. So I think, you know, you got to look to new construction, but there's not a lot of land to build on. And the permit process is, it's time consuming.
Right, right.
It's expensive.
And you do state and local.
Do state and local.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the project we did in Berry Town was a couple of years.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jim, hold that thought. We'll be back. We're on a hard break at the moment. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, back with you on Vermont Viewpoint. With me is Jim Fecteau, Fecteau Homes, and we're talking about housing in Vermont. Jim, we left off with a lot of people's favorite word, besides regulation, permitting. You want to talk a little bit about your experiences with permitting?
Yeah, I was just talking about, you know, what it takes to build a new community.
Right.
And, you know, our experience, and we just did one in Berry Town. It was 90 units. And going through the local process took – and we had, like, it was amazing because we had no opposition. And nobody – came to yell at us that, you know, you're bad people and all that stuff. And but we had no opposition. And, you know, it took a couple years to get through, you know, local and the state level permitting. So it's not something that's easy. It's not something that's cheap. I think we had several hundred thousand dollars of permit fees and engineering and all that stuff. So I think that's what holds up a lot of new development is you got to have the resources, and they're scarce to do all this upfront stuff. It's so there's so much skin in the game before a bank will even talk to you. No bank will finance, you know, a permit acquisition. That's not something that can be done. So I think that does, you know, play a role in stalling a lot of developments.
Any contractor I've ever talked to over the years and whatever job I had or whatever, they all said they just want predictability.
Yeah.
How much and how long.
Yeah.
And they could adjust, but our system doesn't answer either of those questions.
Right, yeah.
Because they just, you know, pull you along.
My father jokes, he met a guy in Burlington, we're doing some work for, and he goes, you know, why don't you hate Act 250? He goes, I love Act 250.
Who said that?
I won't say that.
Oh, okay. Wasn't your father?
No, no.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
He said, I love Act 250. My father says, why? He says, well, because it keeps a lot of people out of the game.
Oh.
It's expensive and it's hard. You know,
lovely.
And that's wrong, but it does. The cost of permitting, the cost of construction keeps a lot of people out of it.
So this guy didn't like the competition, so he loves it.
He loved it.
I love it. Well, yeah, don't tell me who. But I thought you meant your father. I'm like, oh, no, couldn't be Vic.
No, he wouldn't love it.
No, he wouldn't love it. Well, we were going to talk about Act 250, but there was a bill last year that had all kinds of things in it, and the governor vetoed it, fortunately. And I don't think they didn't pursue it. It may be back again this year because they've worked on Act 250 for a couple of years and they just don't seem to get people on board. We have to keep Vermont, environmentally protected. And I think even contractors support that.
Yeah.
I don't think you're anti, but let's get real. There's got to be a balance.
Yeah. I think if you start, we certainly don't want to see, you know, driving up the interstate.
Right.
You know, people don't come here. They come here to look at the landscape and the leaves, and they don't want to see a 75-foot tower that has the price of diesel on it.
Right.
You know, so but I think there's a balance to be had. I mean, we have to make a choice between, especially in places that it makes sense to build.
Yep.
So between neighborhoods or in downtowns, we have to make a choice between maybe housing and some natural resource, you know.
There's a push to try to exempt Act 250 from, I think, Burlington downtown. And I don't know whether that's getting any traction, but just build. Because we need the housing. They need the people. We don't – every place you go, there's a help wanted sign out there.
Yeah, I think
you're very lucky if your folks are staying with you. That says a lot about you and your family.
Yeah. I think it seems to me the focus on Act 250 has been – back towards the downtown.
Yeah.
And, you know, you drive down, I drive down, you know, Summer Street in Barrie, and I look at a bunch of, you know, single family homes that could be torn down and replaced with probably 30 housing units.
Right.
And you think about the impact versus a raw piece of land, there's much less. The streets are already there, the stormwater infrastructure's there, the water and sewer lines are there. The stop signs on the corner.
Right.
the street light is already in. So I think that's probably the best approach is like try to fill in between neighborhoods and use existing infrastructure.
That's great.
For housing and just make it denser.
Yep. I like that idea. That's good. Because I love downtowns anyway. Where I grew up, we always had a downtown, which is a problem in Berlin. We're working on it, though.
I was I went to school in Montreal.
So oh, excellent.
I love being in a downtown.
Right. I do, too. Yeah. And you get to know people better that way. And being rural, it's hard sometimes.
And if you have a few too many beers, you can walk home.
There's always a plus, isn't there? Anyway, I found an article that lists the 10 facts about manufactured homes, and I wanted to talk a little bit about three of them. One said they are technologically advanced and considered green housing, which these days must be a serious plus.
Yeah, I mean, obviously just the amount of waste that goes into traditional building, you know, versus the manufactured housing is it makes them green.
Yep.
And I can order these houses now with an Energy Star rating,
so
you know they're built tighter. The U value in the windows, the R value in the walls and the ceiling are
perfect,
you know, upgraded. So so they're definitely going that way. I mean, we're you know you got to get them to. You know, beef the roofs up so we can put solar panels on them, but they're
interesting. Not there yet, you can't do that now because they're not strong enough.
You got to have a little bit more of a rating. But that's I'm sure that's coming. It's all
I bet it is
heat
because
pumps and all that's coming.
So. We're all looking to that that energy source.
Sure,
that's great. So the other one we sort of talked about, they're faster and less expensive to build, which we've sort of touched on. It's a solid, good house. And plenty of room when you're with the high ceilings. Some of these things are really amazing once you get inside.
Yeah, I do. I walk through sometimes and I'm like, I could definitely be in this one.
Oh, yeah. No, I could. Yeah. I could, too. I love it. Yeah. And the third one I was talking about in this list of 10, they're considered, which is important from a tax perspective, they're considered permanent structures. Thus, they are, quote, real property.
Right.
Which is good.
Yeah.
It's an investment.
Yeah, exactly. The modular homes, once they're placed on a foundation, are just like a stick built. But the mobiles are now, once the axles and the wheels are taken off, they're part of the real estate. So they can be financed like a regular house.
That's great. Now, what do you have on your site? Do you have used homes that people can look at? I remember we were talking about that, and I forget.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll take, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, you drive any back road or any through any mobile home park, there's a lot of old stock out there.
Right.
And we do take some in trade as long as they're, you know, mobile and are in livable condition.
Right.
And we put them actually on the Barrie Montpelier Road there. And that's why we have no room left.
That's correct.
We put them there and refurbish them and then resell them. So they become
great.
They're a great starter house for somebody for, you know, $20,000, $30,000.
Like they do for cars, what, NOS, new old stock?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it makes a great starter. We sell them to, you know, sometimes farmers use them for labor.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
They put them out for that. So they're safe. They just don't have all the features that the new ones have. but it's a good alternative if your budget is at that.
Well, when you were talking about the cost of homes before, all I keep thinking about is these, and since I'm 79, these are young people that graduate from college with a debt everywhere, and then they're trying to start a life, maybe get married. How do they afford these homes with paying off their student loan? It's just, how do you start? You can't.
I don't know because it's they have to pay off a house before they can buy one, really. I mean, it's that is what they get into with education.
Yeah, with the school loan.
It's not I think you're going to see a lot more kids focus on the trades. I mean, why wouldn't you go and work for a plumbing or an electrical or a carpentry outfit, and as you learn
and make good money,
and
make
you're getting paid really to learn, to earn a license, and in 5 years you buy a van, have your own small business. I mean, I've seen this time and time again with our subcontractors. Yep. They start with an outfit, and then they get their license and go out on their own.
Right.
And maybe they have one or two employees. I mean, that is if you're not going for a specific like accounting or to be a lawyer.
Right.
I really think it's worth a look.
I've been so supportive of tech ed, and it's always had that stigma, but it's just not true anymore. Our businesses, like yourself, they're desperate for technically minded employees.
Yeah, I think if you think about what a plumber can charge per hour, it's approaching a doctor's wage. It's there, and it's because there's a need.
It's not going anywhere.
There's the need for skilled labor. And it's not just this state, it's the whole nation.
Right.
The need for skilled labor.
Well, you were talking about solar panels. I had Matt Cota in here the other day. He's got a fuel dealer's background, and now he's working for Vermont Automobile Dealers. And he said that being an electrician is going to be the new job of the future, with the solar panels, with all of the electric cars, the electric power stations.
Oh, yeah.
And he said,
it's
the thing. It's never going to run out.
Electricity. I mean, just the upgrades to our to maybe the grid that need to be made over the next,
it's amazing.
So many years. Skill is going to be in.
You get a license in 2 years, half the cost of college, and you get a job that probably pays more than when you
eventually
get off. It's amazing. So we have to take a quick break. Sorry, Jim. We'll be back in a minute. This is Pat McDonald from Vermont Viewpoint, WDEV. Hi there. We're back. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. I'm here with Jim Fecteau from Fecteau Homes in Montpelier, Vermont. And in the break, we were just talking about heat pumps. And I wanted Jim to talk about that because the RV across from us in camp just put in a heat pump, and he loves it.
Yeah.
And that's in your homes as well, right?
Well, it's not in the manufactured homes yet, but I...
They're coming.
It's coming. I think that's something that they're working on offering, and in Vermont, there's a big push because they're definitely efficient.
Because they're small.
Yeah.
And hot and cold, right?
Yeah, and cold. I have a couple in my house, and I just love them.
And they run off electricity.
And they run off electricity, but they're not resistant types heaters. They're so they're a lot more efficient.
Oh, cool.
And they work to, I mean, mine works probably to 10 degrees. Then after that, it's really struggling. But it's an older version. They keep making them better.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a lot of that work its way into the HUD code.
Excellent.
Product.
That's nice. We're going to put a regular stove in my RV over this next year. We've talked to somebody to put it in.
Yeah.
Because those little stoves in the RVs, you've got to reach to work them. You've got to put your hand and head way in the back to put it on. And I don't use my stove in my RV. I'm scared to death of it.
That was the best part of my park model, is all the appliances
were
full
real
size.
Oh, because, there you go.
Just the fridges in a camper.
Right.
It fills up so fast, and I have no idea what's in there.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of people I know that have been there for years. They all have full-scale models, and I'm getting my stove, because I like to cook, and I feel like what's it, Hansel and Gretel, you know, with the witch telling them to put their head in the stove. So not me. But anyway, we were talking nationally. I asked Jim how they could get the manufacturers to shore up the roof so you could put solar panels on. And that, he said that's going to be law that comes from the feds.
Yeah. And, but I keep pushing this.
Do you?
They've been so busy. You know, their backlogs have been 12 to 18 months.
Right.
So they really have no incentive right now to innovate. But I think now that things are going to change and slow down, they're going to increase their products.
Well, I looked at your national association, and it looks like the feds are understanding the importance of manufacturing housing for the housing crisis, which I'm assuming is not just in Vermont. Oh. It's probably everywhere. And there is, several legislators, congressmen and women have introduced two huge grant programs, one loan program and one bill that deals with tax credits, all to support the manufactured housing community.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go through them because I don't think it applies here. But it's good to see that they get it. And also here in Vermont, one thing that we are always dealing with is drinking water. And that's a real problem in some of these parks. Now, you don't have a park per se, do you?
We don't own any mobile home parks.
Okay.
But we do work with quite a few park owners.
Right.
Replacing houses. And I know that, this money, a lot of these parks were built, you know, quite a few years ago.
So I read a lot about that there's safety and security of the manufactured home community. Do you have any idea what they mean by that? Because it's a housing community. I don't know why they in particular would have problems with security, as we would just treat them like any other community.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah, because we don't have problems like that here in Vermont, do we?
I don't.
Let's not give them any ideas. But Vermont just put in $1.5 million for small grants to mobile home park owners, which is great, to make repairs and improvements, such as removing abandoned homes, fixing up lots and so forth, which is great. And one thing I do like about your facilities in Montpelier is that there's nothing old there. It's all...
Yeah.
It all looks good, and I appreciate that. And so we don't mind when we go by because they're
right.
I'm always – we should put the lights on at night because I like looking in them. So I don't know if there's a couple of other things. I know that when I was doing my research that there's – as you mentioned this yourself, that there's – a lot of these mobile homes are used for temporary schoolrooms, office space. I remember in state government when we had a problem with some of the buildings, they would move in mobile homes and let people work in them. They'd be retrofitted for office space. And do you get calls for that sometimes?
We get calls. I mean, there were manufacturers that specialized in schoolrooms.
Oh, really?
And office space. And I'm not sure. I haven't looked in a while. We haven't got the calls in a while either. But I don't know if those people went out in the 08, 09, you know, crash.
Right.
Or if anybody's doing it again. I know a lot of our manufacturers, they shy because they can only do so much and their backlogs so long. I used to buy commercial space, or let's say multifamily, four-unit buildings. And they're shying away from that because it's a different – you know, the codes are different. It needs third-party, you know, approvals of a different kind. And it's just a lot more work, and it jams up their line. So, but I suspect as, you know, their appetite will increase for doing other things as the residential stuff maybe slows down. So.
That's great. Are you mostly – you're mostly residential. I mean
– We're mostly residential. I mean, as close to commercial as we get is, you know, four-unit apartment buildings or condos. So.
That's great. And where is the place in Barrie that you were talking about? Because you had another big development out there, I remember, sort of near 89.
Yeah, we have we have a project that's on Beckley Hill.
Oh, Beckley,
So it connects – we connected Beckley Hill above St. Monica's Cemetery.
Right.
We connected Beckley Hill to Richardson Road.
Those are beautiful homes.
Yeah, yeah, those came out. We're probably, I would say we're close to 20 into it now.
Nice.
How
many more lots do you have?
Well, we have room for another 70 units.
Oh, excellent.
And we got to name the streets after all the grandchildren.
Oh,
so,
stop.
Yeah, so my son Matthew got a street. And
you've got the cutest kids, honestly. Mom and Dad, I know they love those grandchildren. They're adorable.
But what happened is Dan had another one, and then Jason had another one, so we don't have any more streets.
So we got to get people to order.
We got to start another project.
That's great. I love when you have everybody together and post your family pictures. Mom and Dad are smiling from ear to ear. But anyway, anything else we should talk about? We only have a couple of minutes, I guess. What do you think, looking forward, is there anything in the legislature that you're going to need to push them on at all?
Other than
no regulation? That'd help.
Yeah, no more regulation.
No more,
I think
right.
That's probably it, is let us kind of digest what's going on now. I think the more regulation, it ties things up. It's not a big deal to comply. It's when it takes months and months to get a feedback or to get your permit back.
Right.
You know, I have no problem complying with the rules, but just if we design it, put it in, get us the permit.
Right.
I'm going to be waiting for a permit. And like I said last time, I don't want to name the agency because I don't want to be in trouble. But we have a project that we started, and we're going to be waiting for this for one permit for 6 months,
right.
You know, and that's just because
they're not
staffed. You know, they just don't have enough people to handle the volume of applications.
Right.
And so the more regulation you put on,
the more
applications you get.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you can't staff the office, that's another form of you know, getting in the way of development.
Right. So. Well, because it ties up your money.
Yeah.
Ties up all of your plans for building more.
Yeah, we could be building in the spring, and now we're going to be waiting in the spring.
In the middle of a housing crisis, you would think. I think they make things so complicated anyway because they think they need it. I know when I was at DMV, we took a look at what we were asking people, and half the time I said, "Do you check if that's true?" No.
Yeah.
Well, then why are you asking it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I don't think it's malicious. But
no.
You know, one, like, if an engineer gets a license and you make him carry professional liability.
Right.
Why can they not design something and we can get going?
Right.
If it's wrong, then somebody's going to call them out anyways. And engineers will design with a factor, you know, to cover themselves.
So let us work.
Let us work. Yeah.
Sounds good to me. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Fecto, I appreciate your coming. It wasn't so bad, was it?
No.
Went quick? No.
I told you I'm an introvert. You got me out twice now.
We got you up. This is good for you. It's a good lesson here. Anyway, thank you all for tuning in. Check out Fecto Homes in Montpelier, Vermont. And stay tuned because we have an amazing guest coming up who is going to talk about broken system, broken promises. Check that out. Hi there. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. We are back for our second hour. My guest today is Larry Crist, who's got 2 degrees, JD, and a Master of Social Work, and he is the Executive Director of the Vermont Parent Representation Center. And the topic of our discussion is a report that Larry and his folks put out called Broken System, Broken Promises. You should not miss this hour. Larry, you were here this morning to talk about a powerful, and may I say disturbing, report that you and your co-authors, Trine, is that how you pronounce?
Trina.
Trina. Trina Beck.
Yep.
And Bill Young, who is a former commissioner of Vermont Department of Social and Rehabilitation Services. They published this report about the failure of Vermont Child Abuse Determination and the Child Protection Registry. So hang on, folks. First, Larry, could you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about your background and a little bit about your organization?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Pat. And thank you, WDEV, for allowing me to come on the
air.
Glad
to have you.
So, yes, I've I came to Vermont 35 years ago to work in state government. It seems like only yesterday, but it has been a wonderful 35 years. And in that process, I was the first director of child care and foster care licensing under Bill Young. It was Bill who recruited me to come to Vermont.
Great.
And during the next 25 years, I served as deputy commissioner for the health department and then the commissioner for the Department of Aging and Disabilities, and finally ended my career back in the health department as the director of public health preparedness and anti-terrorism.
Whoa.
So then I went to work after retiring with the American Red Cross, was the director of the Vermont Red Cross.
I remember that.
For 5 years. Right. And thought I was retired again, but was tricked into working with this very, very small nonprofit. And I was promised that this would only take a year and a half to 2 years to do the work that needed to be done. That was 6 years ago.
Well, there you go.
So that's really my background.
That's
and
funny.
It's been a wonderful 35 years in Vermont, but part of my role has always been to identify areas of state government that can work better.
Right.
And to do whatever needed to be done to make that happen.
Now, how did this, the Parent Representation Center, how did that come together?
This,
that is very interesting. Must be new, new?
Actually, no. It's been around for 12 years.
Oh, shame on me.
It's a very, very small nonprofit, and it has worked below the radar screen. It was founded by a number of people who had roots in child welfare, but who were concerned that the current system was not serving families or children very well. So people like Sarah Kobolinsky, who some of your listeners will remember, Trina Beck, and Stephen Habif, who was one of my very good friends, but they founded this organization.
Huh.
And unfortunately, Stephen is no longer with us, and he's missed every day. But Trina was the director of the program, my predecessor, and she is the person who ran the first three pilot projects. I came on board about 6 years ago, and we decided that what we were going to do was we would do studies of the system at that point. So in November of 2018, we produced what is still today, I think, the best overview of Vermont's child protection system. It's a report that's 117 pages long, and it's titled Bending the Curve.
Right.
To improve our child protection system. And as you may remember, bending the curve was a saying that Con Hogan used all the time.
Do you know, I thought of him when I was reading up about this, about the show. I hope everybody knows Con Hogan, remembers and loves Con Hogan, because he was quite the man.
Yep, he was. I worked for Con for 5 years. Well, 5 years as a commissioner.
Good.
And learned a lot.
Yeah.
So basically, that first report came out at the end of 2018. It today is still the best overview, I believe, of the child protection system. And anyone who wants to understand how it works and how it can be made to work better just needs to go online, and they can find that report through our website. This report was a follow-up to that report. It was saying, look, if we found all of these issues that could be fixed at no or little cost.
Right.
What about the substantiation system, which, frankly, what most people in Vermont don't know is that to substantiate or find someone guilty of child abuse or neglect is the greatest power that DCF has.
Right.
A lot of people think DCF can remove your children. They really can't.
The court
removes your children.
Right.
But DCF can determine whether you are considered guilty of child abuse or neglect, and then place you on the child protection registry.
Right.
And that has serious implications.
Right, because I read 30%, if that's correct, I'll have to check, of all jobs rely on that list, the child protection registry, to determine whether you can apply for a job or not. So it's got a real serious impact.
It does have a serious impact. That 30 or 33% is an estimate, because no one knows exactly for sure how many jobs there are
in the job market
at any given time. But really, basically, it's any position that involves being in contact with children,
right?
Nurses, doctors, therapists, any job that relates to a place that cares for children. So you can be a contractor. And you cannot bid or successfully get a bid if it's for a child care center or a school. So the implications are incredibly wide. They're huge.
Right.
Yes.
Now, you talked about the courts. I'm sort of skipping ahead yet, but that's through the CHINS process, right, which
Child in Need of Services.
Child in that, and they rely on the report from the agency in the CHINS process to see whether the child should be removed or not, correct?
Yeah, the investigations from DCF go in two different directions. One is a substantiation process,
right,
which we're talking about, which is purely DCF. But those same elements are what DCF takes to the court, the family court, to say to the state's attorney, this is a serious situation.
Right.
This family should be brought into family court.
Right.
They're two separate systems, but very frequently they start with the same allegations.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to read something from your report to sort of set this discussion up, and I'll quote this. The outcomes demonstrate that the current system is broken in virtually every respect and presents an expensive and destructive disservice to children, families, the state workers who are charged with making the system work, and the Vermont economy alike. Larry, that's a powerful statement.
Well, it is powerful. It was a statement that I hoped we would not have to make. I mean,
right.
I really hoped when we went into this process, which is a test, and the test was that we were going to take people who had been substantiated but who still had their appeal process in place. They could still appeal that. My hope, frankly, was that we would lose every appeal,
right,
which would show that the system is working. It's identifying people. Just the opposite has happened. Of the 26 appeals that have been completed, we have won 26 appeals.
Oh, wow.
Now, half of those individuals had their children removed. That's a level of trauma that,
right,
that I don't know how you describe the degree of trauma there. And that's the reason it's a disservice to the parents, it's a disservice to the children, and it becomes a disservice to the community because these parents,
right,
can't even volunteer at their children's school. They,
right,
can't go on school trips because they're on a registry.
Right.
So
I just saw a statistic that one in every 26 Vermonters is currently listed on the Child Protection Registry. Is that? I hope there's a little wiggle room there. That's,
yes,
a lot of Vermonters.
Yes, there is wiggle room because it's a mathematical issue. There are approximately 25,000 names or individuals on the registry. There are 640,000 Vermonters.
Right.
When you do the math, it comes out to one of every 26, but it's not
really,
oh,
I see,
one of,
okay,
every 26. Because
that's staggering.
Well, it is, but just to have 25,000 people,
right,
on a registry, you wonder, well, what kind of place must we live in?
Right.
Is every parent, you know, a potential abuser? And the answer is no. You know,
right,
that's not the society we have. But it's a stunning number.
Yeah.
And the question becomes, is that really serving a public safety role when an undefined number of those people weren't guilty? And that's what our test showed.
Well, that's what's so tragic here. Let's talk about how you started the process about selecting,
sure,
the cases and to set this up for folks.
Right. Well, that was the beauty. Excuse me. As I mentioned to Pat, I have allergies.
It's okay.
We're a very small nonprofit, as I said, and the resources are limited. The number of people substantiated each year, you know, is significant. It really is between 700 and 900 people every year,
wow,
year in and year out. Now, that's an average. Some years it's been 1,000. Some years it's been closer to 550. But we didn't really select them. What we decided to do was not advertise, not try to do a random sampling because there was no way for us to know who these people were.
Right.
So we simply, through our parent helpline, our family helpline, we waited for people to come to us. We didn't advertise. We didn't say we were doing this. We never announced to anyone that we were actually doing this project. But we would ask people, have you been substantiated? And if the answer was yes, do you still have your appeal rights? Then we decided we would take every case. No pre-screening,
right,
no cherry
Good.
Picking. The only exception was initially we decided that we would not take cases where the person was charged with child sexual abuse.
Oh, right.
And the reason was we thought that there would be medical evidence involved. It's a very complicated process. That was a mistake, actually.
Huh.
We didn't get any child sexual abuse cases until after our 26th case. We still have six cases pending.
Wow.
These are child sexual – four of the six are child sexual abuse cases, and two of the four are juveniles who are charged.
Oh.
And we had two other cases where juveniles were charged. And what we discovered was the failings in the regular system are even more apparent when it comes to child sexual abuse.
So, Larry, we started talking about how these appeals were selected or your cases were selected and talking about sexual abuse cases that came to your attention.
Yes. Yeah, so we started with the first case. I'm really sorry about that. And began to understand how the system worked. And the way it works is that there's a report made, which DCF gets maybe 20 to 22,000 reports a year. Now, those aren't necessarily reports of abuse and neglect. There are just a lot of calls that come to DCF,
right,
in addition to real reports. And many of those reports can be duplicates. You may have a school where seven different people make,
sure,
the same report. And there are reasons for that. Not always great reasons, but reasons. So basically what happens is an investigator investigates, they meet with their supervisor, and the two of those people decide whether, as an example, I'm guilty or not. It's not like a police officer who investigates and then takes the report and gives it to their boss, who then would take it to the state's attorney to decide is there – that doesn't happen in this case. It's those two people,
huh,
who make the decision. And in addition, the state's attorney doesn't say you're guilty of the crime, but you are guilty as far as DCF is concerned because they substantiate you. You are substantiated.
Right.
It's now your job to prove it didn't happen. That's really how the system works. We say, well, there's a due process review, and then you can appeal to the Human Services Board. But the bottom line is you've already been substantiated.
Right,
so
right, in their mind.
Well, not just in their mind. If you don't exercise your appeal rights within the 14-day window you're allowed to do that, you go on the registry.
Oh, wow.
And you lose your appeal right to the Human Services
and
Board.
And I read somewhere where the individual is not allowed to have an attorney, but the state does have somebody from the AG's office. Is that part of this process or later on?
It is, but there's more detail to that.
Okay.
You can have an attorney, but you have to pay for them yourself.
Oh, right. That was the $10,000 to $50,000
that's what we found.
Price tag.
Yes. For the DCF review, the initial review, most attorneys who are good at this, of which there aren't very many because there aren't many cases for them to take,
right,
because not many people can afford the $10,000.
Exactly.
But if you lose at that appeal level and you have to go to the Human Services Board, you're going to pay between $20,000 and our experience is up to $50,000,
wow,
or more. And that's why this system really is a broken system.
Yep.
Because if you have money or you were lucky enough to be in our project, you're going to win. If you don't have money, you are far more than likely not going to win.
It's a little injustice here, Larry.
There's a huge equity issue.
Yeah,
here.
Right, for
and
sure.
And that's not what a system like this is supposed to do. It's
right.
Supposed to determine what's real and what's not.
Right.
So as each case came up and we began to understand how the system worked, and then as we won each case, I began to think there's a problem with what we're doing. It can't be this easy to win these cases because realistically, only of the people who appeal, 5 to 10% are successful in their appeals. How come we're successful every time?
Right.
And what we realized is because we learned how to do this, and those other people don't have an advocate.
And I read that you assign people who have both a legal and hopefully a social worker background to look at these cases, the adjudicators or whatever you were calling them, like yourself, that would understand the legal and the social part, social worker part of the case.
Right. Well, we did that because I have a law degree. but I'm not licensed to practice law.
Right.
So we would get an attorney who would represent them as the attorney, but I or another volunteer with a social services background, and ideally both social services and law,
right.
would work in partnership. So almost every one of our cases had at least two people working on it in tandem, because it was important to redo the investigation entirely. We redid every investigation the DCF did. And what we found was the DCF investigations were substandard, and they were almost substandard in a routine way.
Yep. So I have to say, I feel sorry for the employees, because there's so many employees in state government that are dealing with systems that are broken and don't work. This is a tragic. This deals with families and children, and it's got a little extra concern to it for sure. But they're dealing with a system that's broken, and I'm sure they know it.
And you're absolutely right. This is very difficult for DCF employees.
Right, I can't imagine.
They're put in an untenable position. They have time frames, but their time frames are even shorter than, say, the 60 days that's allowed for an investigation.
Right.
Because meanwhile, someone has alleged that this child is being abused and neglected.
Right.
So there's a huge amount of pressure for them there. The turnover rate is so great that in some states you have to be a DCF worker for 5 years in training before you can become an investigator.
Wow.
That's not true in Vermont, because the turnover is so great.
Yeah.
So we have some investigators who are well-trained, well-experienced, and very good. We have others, unfortunately, who are not.
Right.
And you don't get to pick and choose who's going to investigate your case.
Right. Well, I wanted to go through these five findings that resulted from your review. And there's some other findings that you had put in this report later on. 26 of them, the entire alphabet. I thought, whoa. But let's just do these five right now, because
sure.
It's important. You said your first finding is that the identified failures are self-inflicted by the system.
Sure. The system that we have today was not designed for today. It was designed for an earlier time. What I mean by that is about the registry itself came into being because the federal government said to each state, you need to be able to tell us how many people are being abused.
Right.
The feds created this system. They said, if you have a reasonable expectation that someone has abused them, that's good enough. So it's called the reasonable person standard.
Right.
But the registry was not used by employers. The registry was only used by the State Child Protection Agency, named SRS then.
Right.
And it was only used to decide whether the state should give you a license to be a foster parent or a child care person. No one has a right to a license. You have the right to apply, but not a right to have the license. However, the legislature, in its wisdom, decided that, wait a minute, if we have a list of abusers, why can't schools and other places have access to that? And there was a lot of discussion by people who said, wait a minute, the system we currently have doesn't provide constitutional due process.
Right.
We are taking people's ability to work away from them. In some cases, we're removing their children because of this system. The legislature, for whatever reason, didn't understand that. So the old system was moved forward and used for this new purpose.
Wow.
And consequently, we have a system now where a worker can say, a reasonable person would think you did it, Pat, as an example.
Right.
And if you have the wherewithal and you appeal, you might lose the DCF review. But when you go to the Human Services Board, it's not a reasonable person standard. It's a preponderance
of the evidence. Which is much different.
It is much higher.
Right.
It is something that is constitutionally compliant. It's
right.
What you have to have if you're going to take someone's rights or liberties away.
Right.
So DCF will do an investigation based on one low standard, knowing that it's not going to pass when it gets to the Human Services Board. But
and
the
it's
law
up
says
to you,
they have to do it.
It's up to the accused or whatever to prove it, right? Right or wrong, not DCF, yeah.
Well, actually, the law says that the burden is on DCF.
Oh.
However, the burden of proving reasonable person, let's do it this way. You probably have 10 friends that you would invite to dinner. all of your friends are reasonable people. Do they all agree on everything you
talk about? Well, right,
right. And that's what happens in this instance. If you're in one office, one district office for DCF, you might get one decision. If you're in another office, you'd get it.
No uniformity.
And exactly. Yep. There isn't any uniformity. Yep. But when you go to the Human Services Board, the state actually has to bring the evidence, and the state is represented by the Attorney General. The problem is that so few people can actually go to the Human Services Board.
Well, who the heck's got $10,000 to $50,000, even though it's about your child, and that's – you probably would spend every dime you have, but who's got it?
Well, exactly. Who has it? And the other reason is that people – will often represent themselves, but they don't understand the law. They don't understand the rules of evidence. And the Human Service Board attempts to help those people, but they're the judges, so they can't be the defense attorney at the same time.
Right. We're going to go to break now. We've got a hard break to take. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. We'll be back shortly on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald. We're back with Vermont Viewpoint, and joining me is Larry Chris. We have a caller on the phone. Caller, go ahead. Do you have a question for Larry or a statement?
Oh, I have a statement. I'm actually one of Larry's previous clients that went through this whole process with him. And I can say, you know, as Larry has said, this whole process is incredibly difficult as a parent. Unfortunately, when you are substantiated, you are guilty until you are proven innocent.
Right. Well, and I tell you, when I read the report, I kept running downstairs to my husband, reading him parts of it, because I'm like, listen to this. I was truly saddened and appalled. And if you went through it, and I just feel sorry.
I appreciate that. Yeah, Larry helped me for 2 cases. And help me win both of them. Unfortunately, when you are substantiated, it's not anybody looking at actual evidence.
Right.
It's mostly based on the opinion of a Department of Child Service worker. And that was my experience. I'm a huge advocate for my children. I have one that suffers with extreme mental health issues. And, they didn't like me because of that. And it was definitely like I was treated differently because of the fact that I am a huge advocate for my children.
Yeah.
And they used that against me. So without Larry there to kind of keep me in a good space, I probably would have lost that case. And unfortunately, we did lose one of our cases with the Human Services Board only due to violation of due process on DCF part.
Well, let me have Larry weigh in here a minute.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for calling. And you're absolutely right. One clarification. We didn't lose that case. We won that case, too.
So you won them both.
What we found was that there had been ex parte communication. In other words, the DCF hearing officer, if you would, or review officer, had in fact gone back and gotten additional information from the department that we were not privy to.
Oh, great.
And that's called ex parte communication. Right. And the Vermont Supreme Court has made it very clear that Justice Robinson explained in a large footnote that that is not permissible because it's unfair. How can you defend yourself
if you don't know
what is being said about
exactly.
you? So,
exactly.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for calling. I've known Larry for years, and I can imagine what you're saying is absolutely true and then some. So thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Let me give everybody the number if you want to call in, 244-1777. I know this is a difficult discussion to have, but we're here to listen. So thank you. We'll go back to the findings. The second thing you found out, Larry, was that DCF investigations, which is just what you were talking about, notifications and appeal process are ineffective and inefficient, and they don't share, and they don't get information back and forth. So that's a problem.
Well, it's a problem when the investigations are substandard. That's the first problem. The biggest issue, though, is that once the investigation is done, a person who's been substantiated has to find someone who will go back and completely reinvestigate again, which means go to all of the witnesses, look at everything DCF did, and then go beyond that to find out, oh, wait a minute, you mean that this child told a different story to their therapist? Well, why isn't that in the record? And you go back and you find that, yeah, the therapist did hear a different story.
Wow.
And the therapist told the DCF investigator, but the investigator did not put it in their report. Why? I have no idea. But then the difficulty is, once you have your first appeal, the only thing you're given about what you're alleged to have done is a report that is about 50% of it is redacted. It's blacked out.
Yeah.
And that is part of the old system when it didn't involve property rights or liberty interest. That's the reason I'm saying it's self-inflicted.
For sure.
So your children's names can be blacked out there. You don't even – I've read these reports and not known who did what to whom. But that's what you're supposed to defend yourself with. The irony is the moment you appeal to the Human Services Board, you get that same report not redacted. There's nothing
because
in it. So the question is why, and the reason is because the statute is old, and that's what the statute tells DCF to do.
Is there any guidelines about what can and can't be redacted in statute, or it's up to the individual reading the report?
There are guidelines. It's really so that because originally when SRS did investigations, they were the only ones who saw them.
Yeah.
So they didn't need to do anything other than if they were going to tell you you couldn't have a license, they had to tell you why. But they didn't have to give you the names of people because it wasn't like a criminal prosecution.
Oh, I see.
But it changed when the registry became something that employers could access. No one changed the law. And so what I mean by many of the problems are self-inflicted is because DCF is operating under statutes that don't work anymore. They were created for a
right.
much simpler time.
And what's upsetting is all of this information follows to the courts under the CHINS process, and the courts are looking at incorrect or incomplete information.
In many instances, that's true, and it can go further than that. You can have a court decision where the court says that you did not do X, Y, and Z.
When you did.
But DCF is still substantiating you
oh.
for X, Y, and Z. And if you don't know, if you don't hire an advocate, you don't know that you can get the court transcript and bring it to the DCF hearing and say a judge said this didn't happen, or vice versa. DCF itself can decide in a substantiation review that they were wrong.
Wow.
But in court, the CHINS case goes forward with those same allegations.
There.
And DCF doesn't have to tell the court that it has already overturned this. It's because the two systems don't talk to one another. It's really crazy making.
Oh, more than that, I would say. Good thing we're on the air. Just so anybody wants to call in, the number is 244-1777. Larry Crisp and Pat McDonald, here we are. So let me – and the third finding was exactly what you were just talking about, that the registry has evolved over the years to become a screening tool for about a third of jobs in Vermont. That's a lot of jobs. That impacts the economy, especially if it's inaccurate.
Well, it's – you're absolutely right. Further than that, it's a situation where many of the jobs that you're now excluded from, working in schools, et cetera, are typically jobs that women have held, and they are typically
right.
the jobs that women have used to get out of poverty. So if you're a woman, which is who most of the people are who are substantiated, you're precluded from getting out of the situation you're in because the jobs that you normally would train for and move into, you can't have. And we've had just recently, we had someone's record expunged who's been training to be a teacher for several years, but couldn't.
No, not on
the
list.
On the registry.
Yep.
And
it's a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. And it's one of these things where you say, wait, we talk about trying to get people out of poverty or to help them improve their circumstances. And at the same time, we're saying, because this happened to you. And one of the reasons that this is so egregious in my mind is when you're substantiated, Pat, let's say it's you, you will receive a letter in the mail from DCF. DCF didn't tell you beforehand that that's how they're going to notify you. You've moved twice.
I haven't let them know.
You didn't let them know because no one told you you were supposed to let them know. You have by law, and that's what I mean by the old system, 14 days from either the date on the letter or the postmark to get your response into DCF to say, I would like a review. Well, in today's system, it can take – it's no longer one-day mail delivery in Vermont.
Right, that's true.
So if the date is October 6th on the letter, the postmark is 7th, you see the problem. You have 2 or 3 days to appeal.
It's not fair.
No,
it's just not fair.
Fair.
We have a call, Brian from Eden. Brian, go ahead. Do you have a question for Larry?
First of all, thank you so much for the work you're doing revising the system. It's nothing is worse when the kids feel like the rescuers are here. And then the rescuers aren't rescuing. It is one of the most damaging things. You know, you feel you drop a dime, the Calvary came, they're going to rescue the kid, and then
they don't.
That's just the beginning of the epic. Yeah.
Yep.
It's really demoralizing. So I so appreciate the work. This might be a little off topic, but we have a lot of foster kids up in Lamoille County here. And I worked with kids for years. And one of the biggest unaddressed issues, and this might be outside the scope of what you're talking
about.
That's okay. I'd like to hear if there was an update. It was abuse by other kids in the foster homes. Kids were being traumatized, you know, and just how that was being treated very differently than like a parent being accused.
Yep, Larry's shaking his head yes. Let me have him respond to you. Thank you, Brian.
Yep.
Brian, thank you. And you have touched on an issue that we've experienced as well, and that is that allegations of abuse that occur within foster homes are sometimes dealt differently with than the allegations when it relates to a parent, in large part because I think there's so much pressure on DCF to find placements for children. And it is a very hard job. Being a foster parent is not an easy thing to do. And so DCF wants to make doubly sure that there's a reason for removing children from a foster home because they're just going to have to move them to another foster home, as opposed to when they look at a family and saying, okay, if we remove the child, we can put them in foster care. Now, they don't do that lightly, but they do it oftentimes without real evidence. They do it just with information, and then they make an assumption.
Great.
And once the child is in foster care, first of all, DCF's responsible for them, so they're more careful with what they do. And also, they need a placement for these children. So,
but
it does happen. Yep. You're absolutely right.
Oh, gosh, this is a very sad story. This is terrible here. Anyway, I just want to go through these last two findings, and we pretty much touched on it. But the fifth one, you said you note that the majority of needed reforms are largely about process and setting consistent standards and cost little or nothing to implement. So I hope that that people pay attention to this. We haven't even touched this report. We've just skimmed the surface, and I'm going to have Larry back sooner rather than later. There was a report I just mentioned to you on WCAX. It was night before last. It was Wednesday night. And the response from DCF was, well, they're focused, if I may paraphrase, on the children, and Larry's organization is focused on the parents. But I would suggest to both that the word is family. And make the family work or help the family. It's not parents versus children. It's the family.
Absolutely. And I think that that is a struggle that DCF has because it has a dual mission.
Right.
And it's very hard. And our role, it says, the Parent Representation Center, but in fact, every parent has a child. So we're as much involved with what happens with the child as we are with the parent. And then, as I mentioned to you earlier, Pat, of the 26 cases here, 4 of them are children who were substantiated.
Really?
Yes.
Can you share the ages of those?
15.
Oh, okay.
15 and 16. 15.
Wow.
And what we have found in 2 of those is those are 2 of the cases that are overturned. There are another 2 right. that are pending right now.
You know, what comes to mind is I wonder what life that they lived going before that 15th birthday. They must have dealt with a whole bunch of things.
In some cases, yes, but in other cases,
no. Interesting.
No. It's an allegation was made, and they couldn't disprove it, right. So they were substantiated.
Wow.
Or they were a child with a developmental disability.
Ah, right.
And they were engaged in an activity which they could not defend themselves about.
Larry, we have to pause because Commissioner Young is on the phone. Bill, you know you're talking to one of your fan members here. It's so good to hear you. Hi.
Hello, Pat. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you. You too, sir. Thank you. Come on. You got a comment, I'm sure. Thank you for doing this report, by the way.
Well, I contributed in a very modest way to it. I just wanted to say, you know, there's nothing exaggerated or made up in this report that Larry has largely written. The cases he describes and the problems in the system often seem unbelievable. They did to me when I first heard them, but they're true. I've been hearing about them and examining these cases for 4 years, and, you know, at the least hundreds of children and families every year are being harmed by a system that's supposed to be protecting them, and it's an outrage, and your listeners should be outraged. And I hope we're prompted to contact legislators and ask them after the election when we know who's for sure who's going
right.
to be there. You know, I hope they contact their legislators and really tell them that this has to stop.
Right.
It's just it is unbelievable, but I hate to tell your listeners, but it's true. And this can't continue in our little state.
Right. No, I so agree. And I would encourage people to get a copy of this report because, I was just reading the text part of it, but there are pages of, data that's been analyzed and it's data. I mean, it's there. It's proof that we've got a problem here. So Larry just wrote me an email where you can find it.
It's a web page.
www.vtprc.org. He writes like a doctor. www.vtprc.org. Look it up. You will find it fascinating as I do, and we will not let this issue go away because, as I said before, this is about Vermont families, and we need to correct it. Thank you, Bill, for calling. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all your service to Vermont. What were you, the longest-serving commissioner in the United States? Was that your?
Okay. Yes, I was.
Yes, we won't say how long that is. We'll keep that between us. But anyway, one of my favorite people in state government. Thanks, Bill, and thanks for the work.
Okay. I hope to talk to you soon.
See
thank you.
Love him.
Absolutely.
We won't talk about our stories about the thrush. We'll keep that off the air. But I'm looking in this report. There are major, as we just read a couple of the findings, but there are 26 major findings, and I circled a whole bunch of them. Things like forensic interviews were not recorded. Things were not formally, investigators did not formally memorialize critical testimony. It just goes on and on, and I'm hoping that DCF appreciates the work that you've done and just fix it. We had a slogan in motor vehicles when I was there. Our slogan was just fix it.
Yep.
this isn't hard. It won't cost money. And I think you made a point, if there were times where money had to be spent, it would be well balanced out on the other side. Money well spent.
Yep, absolutely. And I think it's important to say that DCF is aware of these issues. They've certainly been made aware of them as this report has unfolded, because this isn't a secret. You know, I've worked on an internal committee with DCF for the last few years, and there's been a recognition that there are things that need to change. And DCF is trying to make internal changes now. The problem is DCF is a bureaucracy, and there's a positive to a bureaucracy and a negative. And the negative is they don't change easily, and they usually don't change enough. So there is, I think, goodwill on DCF's side to begin openly
addressing people.
This. They are. And that's important to remember. This is a system problem. This is not a people problem. But the reality is, if the system is hurting people, then it becomes a people problem, and especially if it's hurting children and it's hurting their parents at the same time. So I think that we're going to find common ground as we move forward with the legislature, because some of these things DCF can change itself. Others, the law has to change.
Right.
They're antiquated laws, but DCF is still stuck having to live with them. We have to help change that.
So we were talking about the legislature. Who are the key committees? The judiciary?
It would probably be the judiciary committees, and the health and welfare are the related committees in that arena.
Okay, because Larry has put in here many recommendations, and none of them seem very common sense to me.
That's how they struck me.
Well, no, I was looking at it like, how hard can this be? I mean, it's pretty common sense. When we would have hearings at motor vehicles, hardly the same issue. But we had a document and had to send by certified mail and do all this stuff. It's the same at DCF.
It is the same at DCF, except that the statute says that the notification is to be done by first-class mail.
Really? That's interesting.
They could do first-class mail and something else, but they haven't had to do that in the past.
Right.
And one of the big problems here, though, is that DCF doesn't really know whether a letter was actually mailed or not.
So they don't document so when does the 14 days kick off? You don't know.
It starts from the date on the letter or the date on the postmark. Those are available, okay? And sometimes there's a couple days difference.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the same. But the issue is there is a law that says first-class mail. They have policies about how it's done and practices about how it's done. But no one actually documents that they actually put the letter in the mail. So DCF's response when someone is late is to say, well, we didn't get a returned letter to us, so that proves you received it.
Oh, not.
And what we showed in one of our successful cases here was that, wait a minute, no. Not getting a return letter isn't proof that you didn't get it.
Right.
If anything, it could be proof you never mailed it.
Right.
And in one case, the Human Service Board actually said, yeah, we agree with that. Not the board itself. It was in a settlement hearing. But that's one of the problems. It's very easy to change this stuff if you take the next step, but it's much easier if we put it in statute in the first place.
Right.
To say, this is how you notify people. You tell them ahead of time. You get an email address, a telephone number, and you send a certified letter. And one of those is going to reach them.
Well, I encourage you all to please look this report up. I'm sure you'll be as disheartened as I was. And we will have Larry back, I can guarantee you. Maybe we, even with DCF, we'll have a discussion, because, may I say, every process can be changed and fixed and tightened up no matter what. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Larry, for coming on. I appreciate it. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.